swear I'm going to find out the truth. I'm going to find out what happened. I promise. She says nothing. Her eyes shift under her lids, and I remember Flo at the séance, blindly searching for something none of us could see. I think my heart might break. But I can't stop. They could be looking for me right now. Carefully, stealthily, I peer out of the cubicle curtains. The corridor is empty. The nurse's station is unmanned. They are all dealing with patients, and the matron has disappeared. I slip out, closing Claire's curtains behind me, and then I almost run for the doors at the end of the ward and stumble out into the lift lobby. I press the buttons, not once, but 5, 10, 15 times, pressing again and again as if it will make the lifts come faster. Then there's a sudden grating noise and a ping, and the farthest lift doors open. I half walk, half run inside, my heart thudding. A porter is in there, pushing a woman in a wheelchair and hissing Lady Gaga through his teeth. Please, please, let me make it. The lift bumps to a halt, and I stand back to let the porter and the woman out first, and then follow the signs to the main entrance. A bored-looking woman is sitting at the desk, flicking through a copy of Hello. As I draw level with her, her phone starts to ring, and I cannot stop myself walking a little faster. Don't pick it up. Don't pick it up. She picks it up. Hello, reception desk. I am walking too fast. I know I am, but I can't stop myself. I must look like a patient. How can she not notice I'm wearing flip-flops, for Christ's sake? Normal people, visitors, don't wear flip-flops in November, not with grey jogging bottoms and a blue knitted cardigan. She is going to stop me. I know it. She's going to say something, ask me if I'm okay. The 2 £10 notes clutched in my fist are damp with sweat. Really? The receptionist says sharply as I draw level. She winds the phone cord around one finger. Yes. Yes, all right. I'll keep an eye out. My heart is in my mouth. She knows. I can't bear it. But she doesn't look up. She's nodding. Maybe it's not me they're talking about. I'm almost at the door. There's a sign telling people to use the alcohol rub on entry and exit. Should I stop? Will someone notice more if I stop, or more if I don't? I don't stop. At the desk, the woman is still talking and shaking her head. I am in the revolving door. For a moment, I have a brief, flashing fantasy that it will stop mid-cycle, that I will be trapped in a triangle of air with maybe just a sliver of a gap to the outside, enough to reach an arm out but not escape. But of course it doesn't happen. The door continues its smooth revolution. The cold air hits me like a blessing. I am free. I am out of the hospital. I have escaped. Chapter 30. The air is cold in my face, and I feel completely lost. This place is totally strange to me, and I realize suddenly and piercingly that I was brought here unconscious and have no clue how I got here or how to get away. I'm shivering after the heat of the hospital, and there are flecks of snow on the breeze. I look up as if searching for a miracle, and one comes, in the form of a sign saying, "Taxis," and an arrow. I walk slowly, shivering, round the corner of the building, and there, at the sign saying, "Taxi queue starts here," is a single cab, light on. A man is inside, at least I think so. It's hard to see through the fog on the windows. I limp closer. The flip-flops are starting to chafe the inner side of my foot, and knock on the window. It rolls down a crack, and a cheerful brown face grins at me.
"What can I do for you, love?"
he asks. He is a Sikh, his turban a smart black with a pin in the centre with his taxi company's logo on. His accent is a disconcerting mix of Punjabi and Newcastle that momentarily makes me want to laugh. I need to get to... I have no idea where to go. Back to London? No. I need to get to the glass house, I say. It's a cottage, a house, just outside Stainbridge. Do you know the village? He nods and puts down his paper.
I know it. Hop in, love.
But I don't. In spite of the cold and the fact that I'm shivering hard now, I hesitate, my hand on the door handle. How much will it be, please? I've only got £20.
It's 25 normally, he says, taking in my bruises. But for you, I'll say 20.
Thank God. I manage a smile, though my face feels like it is frozen and might crack with the effort. Thank you, I say, not stammering now, but my teeth chattering with cold.
Get in, love.
He opens the door behind him.
Or you'll freeze. Hop in now.
I get in.
The car is like a cocoon of warmth that folds around me. It smells of worn plastic and pine air freshener and old cigarettes, the smell of every taxi everywhere,
and I want to curl into the soft warmth of its seats and go to sleep and never wake up. My fingers, as I try to buckle my belt, are trembling, and I realize how tired I am, how weak my muscles are after my hospital stay. Sorry, I say as he glances back to make sure I'm buckled up. Sorry, I'm nearly there.
No worries, love. No hurry.
And then the buckle closes with a reassuring click, and I sit back, feeling my body ache with tiredness. The driver starts the engine. I close my eyes. I am away.
Hey, love. Wake up, miss.
I open my eyes, confused and bleary. Where am I? Not at home, not in the hospital. It takes a minute before I realize that I'm in the back seat of the taxi, in my hospital clothes, and the car has stopped.
We're here,
he says.
But I can't get up to the house. The road's blocked.
I blink and wipe the condensation off the window. He's right. A roadblock has been put across the lane, two aluminium barriers lashed together with police tape. It's all right. I rub the sleep out of the corners of my eyes and feel in my pocket for the money. Here you go. 20, was that right? He takes the money but says,
Are you sure you'll be all right, love? Looks like the house is shut up.
I'll be fine. Will I? I have to be. There must be a way in. I imagine the police will have secured the property, but I can't believe they will have turned it into Fort Knox, not out here. There's no one to come and disturb the scene. The taxi driver's face is unhappy as I get out the car, and he watches me, the engine idling as I edge round the barrier. I don't want him to. I can't bear him to see me stumbling up the rutted track in my pathetic flip-flops. Instead, I stand with my hands on the barrier, trying not to shiver, and wave at him determinedly. He winds down the window, his breath gusting white into the cold air.
Are you sure you're all right? I can stay if you like. Take you back to Stainbridge if there's nobody about. I won't charge. It's on my way back anyway.
No, thanks, I say. I grit my teeth, trying not to let them chatter. I'm fine, thanks. Goodbye now. He nods, still unhappy, and then revs the engine, and I watch as his car disappears into the falling dusk, the red tail lights illuminating the falling snow. Jesus, this drive is long. I had forgotten how long. I remember the run, when I met Claire coming up, my legs tired and aching and my skin cold. That was nothing to this. What has happened to my muscles in hospital? I'm not even halfway up and my legs are trembling with those muscle shakes that come after you've pushed yourself too hard and too fast. My feet in the hard plastic flip-flops are bleeding, but they're so numb I can't feel any pain. I only know what has happened from the smears of red that mingle with the flecks of snow. The mud, at least, has frozen, so I'm not fighting against the cloying lumps sticking to my feet. But when I stumble into a particularly deep rut, there's a crack, and my foot goes through the thin crust of ice into the freezing pool of muddy water beneath. I gasp and make a kind of squeaking whimper as I pull my foot painfully out through the sharp ice. It is a thin, pathetic sound, like a mouse being caught by an owl. I am so cold. I am so very, very cold. Have I been very stupid?
But I have to carry on. There's no sense in going back. Even if I could flag down someone on the road, where would I go? Back to the hospital and the waiting cuffs of Lamar?
I've run away. Absconded. I have to see this through. There is no way back. I force my feet, one in front of the other, my arms wrapped around myself for warmth, thanking God and Nina for the blue cardigan, which is the only thing keeping me from hypothermia. The wind blows again, a low, moaning howl through the trees, and I hear the snow shake and patter to the ground. One more step, and one more after that. I cannot tell how close I am. With the house empty, there are no glowing lights to guide me. I have no sense of how long I've been walking in this bitter cold, only that I have to keep going because if I don't, I will die. One more step. There are pictures in my head as I get closer. Flo, her face twisted with fear, the gun across her chest. Nina's horrified expression, her blood-stained hands as she tried to staunch the flow. James. James lying in a pool of his own blood, dying. I know now what he was trying to say when he said, "Te, Leo." It wasn't tell, it was text. He was asking me why I'd brought him here, and why I'd let him die like this. He came for me. He came because I asked him. Did I ask him? I'm no longer sure. Oh my God, I'm cold. It's hard to keep things straight in my head. I remember the texts Lamar showed me on that printed paper, and I'm no longer sure if I'm remembering them from when she showed me, or before that. Did I ask James to come? I didn't know that Claire was marrying James until she told me in the car. I didn't know. So why would I have texted him? I must cling to that. I must cling to what I'm sure of. It must have been Flo. She was the only person who could have controlled all this, who chose the guests, who picked the house, who knew about the gun. She was in the house when the texts were sent. She knew I'd gone for a run. I think again of her strange intensity, of her huge, explosive, terrifying love for Claire. Is it possible that she thought she might lose Claire to James? That she couldn't bear for him to come between them? And what better person to pin the blame on than me, James's ex-girlfriend, Claire's best friend? And then she realized what she had done. That she'd destroyed her friend as well as her rival, that she had ruined Claire's life, and she couldn't take it anymore. Oh my God, I'm so cold. I'm so tired. There's a fallen tree by the side of the lane. I could sit on it just for a minute, just to stop the shaking in my legs. Step by laborious step, I make my way to it and sink down onto its rough, moss-covered side. I huddle my body down to my knees, breathing into my legs, desperately trying to conserve some warmth. I shut my eyes. I wish I could sleep.
No.
The voice comes from somewhere outside me. I know it's not real, and yet I hear it in my head.
No.
I want to sleep.
No.
If I sleep, I will die. I know that. But I don't care anymore. I am so tired.
No.
I want to sleep. But something won't let me. Something inside me won't let me rest. It's not a desire to live. I don't care about that anymore. James is dead. Claire is hurt. Flo is dying. There is only one thing left. And that is the truth. I will not die. I will not die because someone has to do this, has to get to the truth of what happened. I get up. My knees are shaking so much that I can hardly stand, but I do, steadying myself with a hand on the fallen tree. I take a step, and another. I will keep going. I will keep going. Chapter 31. I don't know how long it takes me. Darkness has fallen. The hours seem to drift together, blurring into the snow that is speckling the frozen mud. I am tired. So tired that I can't think, and my eyes water as I walk into the wind that has begun to blow. My face is quite numb, and my eyes are wet and blurred when, at last, I look up, and there it is. The glass house. It's no longer the great golden beacon I saw that first night. Instead, it's dark and silent, blending into the trees, almost invisible. A half moon has risen, and it reflects off the bedroom window at the front, the bedroom that Tom slept in. There's a frost halo around it, and I know the night is only going to get colder. The darkness is not the only difference. There's police tape across the door, and the broken window at the top of the stairs has been boarded over with a kind of metal grill, the sort you see on vacant houses in rough areas. I walk the last few painful yards across the gravel and stand, shivering and staring at the blank glass wall in front of me. Now I'm here, I'm not sure I can do this. Go inside, revisit where James died. But I have to. Not just because of James. Not just because it's the only way I will ever find out the truth about what happened. But because if I don't get inside, into shelter, I will die of exposure. The front door is locked, and there are no windows I can force. I pick up a rock and consider the huge glass wall of the living room. I can see inside, to the cold, dead wood burner and the flat blackness of the TV screen. I imagine heaving the rock at the giant pane, but I don't. It's not just the huge noise and destruction, but I don't think it would break. The pane is double, maybe even triple glazed. It took a shotgun blast to break the one in the hall. I'm pretty sure my puny rock would just bounce off this one. I drop the rock and make my way slowly, painfully around to the back of the house. My feet are totally numb, and I stumble more than once, seeing the blood coming up between my toes as I do. I push away the thought of how I will get away from here. I can't walk, that's for sure, but I have a horrible feeling it will be in a police car. Or worse. The back of the house looks equally unpromising. I try the long, sliding French door to the rear of the living room, prising my nails around the flat glass panel and trying to pull it sideways, hoping desperately that the catch is not locked. But it stays firm, and all I manage to do is rip my bitten nails. I look up at the sheer side of the house. Could I climb up to the balcony where Nina smoked? For a minute, I consider it. There's a zinc drain pipe. But then reality bites. I'm kidding myself. There's no way I could climb that slippery glass wall, even with climbing shoes and a harness, let alone in flip-flops and with numb fingers. I was always the first person to fail the climbing ropes at school, hanging there pathetically, my skinny arms stretched above my head, before I dropped like a stone into a crumpled heap on the rubber mat, while other girls swarmed to the top and smacked the wooden bar overhead with the flat of their palm. There's no rubber mat here, and the zinc pipe is slippier and more treacherous than a knotted gym rope. If I fell, it'd be all over. I'd be lucky to get away with a broken ankle. No, the balcony is not going to work. At last, almost without hope, I try the back door. And it swings open. I feel something prickle across the back of my neck. Shock, disbelief, a kind of fierce elation. I can't believe it. I can't believe the police didn't lock it. Can it really be this easy, after everything else has been so hard? There's police tape across the opening, but I duck under it and half walk, half crawl inside. I straighten up, almost expecting sirens to go off, or a policeman to stand up from a seat in the corner. But the house is dark and quiet. The only movement, a few flakes of snow scudding across the slate floor. I put my hand out to swing the door shut, but it doesn't close properly. It hits the frame, but bounces back open. I grab it, to try again, and as I do, I notice something. There's a piece of tape across the tongue of the latch, preventing it from shutting completely. Suddenly, I understand why the door kept swinging open that night. Why, even after we locked it, it was never secure. The lock is the kind that just immobilizes the door handle, stops it from turning the latch, but if the latch itself is pushed back, the handle is useless. It feels stiff when you rattle it, but there's nothing holding the door shut but its own inertia. For a second, I think about ripping the tape off, but then I realize how stupid that would be. This, finally, is proof. In front of me, hidden innocently within the doorframe, is cast iron proof that someone set James up to die. And whoever placed the tape was that person. Carefully, without disturbing it, I push the door shut, and then I drag a chair across the kitchen to rest against the inside of the glass. Then, for the first time, I look around. The kitchen looks strangely undisturbed. I don't know what I was expecting. Fingerprint dust, perhaps, that silver sheen on every surface. But as soon as I think about this, I realize how pointless it would be. None of us ever denied being in the house. Our prints would be all over the place, and what would that prove? I want, more than anything, to crawl upstairs to one of the beds and sleep. But I can't. I may not have much time. By now they've probably discovered my room is empty. They'll know I can't have gone far under my own steam, not without money, shoes, and a coat. It won't take them long to find the taxi driver, and when they do... I walk through the kitchen, my footsteps loud in the echoing silence, take a deep breath, and then open the door to the hallway. They've cleared up, to some extent, anyway. Much of the blood has gone, along with most of the glass, although I can feel the occasional tiny sliver crunch under my plastic soles. In its place, there are markings on the floor, on the walls, bits of tape with notations I can't read in the darkness. I don't dare switch on a light. There are no curtains to draw, and my presence would be visible from right across the valley. But there are specks left here and there, dark rust splashes of something that used to be James, and now is not. It's the strangest thing. He is gone, and his heart's blood is still here. I kneel on the soft wooden parquet, pitted with chunks of glass ground in by our shoes, and marked by the soaking blood, and I touch my fingers to the stained grooves of the wood, and I think, this was James. A couple of days ago, this was inside him, keeping him alive, making his skin flush and his heart beat. And now it's gone. It's lying here, wasted. And yet it's all that's left of him. Somewhere his body is being post-mortemed, and then he'll be buried or cremated. But a part of him will be here, in this house. I get up, forcing my cold, tired legs to work. Then I go to the living room and grab one of the throws off the sofa. There are dirty wine glasses still on the table from our last night. Fag butts are stubbed out in the dregs of wine, Nina's roll-ups bloated into soggy white worms. But the planchette has been packed away and the paper has gone. I cannot suppress a shiver at the thought of the police reading those deranged scrawlings. What did it mean, that long, looping murderer? Did someone write it deliberately? Or did it simply float up from the group subconscious like a sea monster surfacing from someone's innermost fears and then sinking back down? The throw smells of stale cigarette smoke, but I hug it round my shoulders as I glance up at the empty pegs above the fireplace and away. I can't really bear to think of what I'm about to do, but I must do it. It's my only chance to get to what really happened. I start at the top of the stairs, standing where we all stood that night in a little huddle. Flo was to my right, and I remember putting out my hand to the gun. Claire and Nina were on the other side, Tom behind us. The scene, with the quiet and the darkness and my own thudding heart, is so close to that night that for a moment I feel almost faint, and I have to stand and breathe through my nose and remember that it is done. James is not coming up those stairs. We killed him, between us with our drunken, hysterical fear. We all held that gun. I have to force myself to retrace what happened next. James's body tumbling down the stairs, Nina and I stumbling after. This time I walk down slowly, holding the banister. There is still glass on the stairs from the broken window, and I don't trust my flip-flops in the darkness, not with the skidding shards underfoot. Here was where Nina tried to resuscitate James. Here was where I knelt in his blood, and he tried to speak. I feel tears, wet on my face, but I scrub them away. There is no time for grief. The hours are ticking down until dawn, until they come and get me. What happened next? The living room door is still off its hinges from when Tom took it down, and we struggled with it out through the front door to where Claire was waiting in the car. The front door is not deadlocked, and I open it from the inside without difficulty. When I do, the force of the wind nearly bangs the steel door into my face, and the snow rushes inside like a living thing, trying to get in, trying to force what little warmth is left in the house back out. I screw up my eyes, and, holding the throw hard round my shoulders, I step out into the white blizzard. I stand on the porch where I stood that night, waiting for Nina. I remember Tom calling out something to Claire, and Claire gunning the engine. And then I remember noticing that her coat was lying over the porch rail. I put out my hand, pretend to pick it up. I'm shivering, but I'm trying as hard as I can to remember back to that night, to the shape of something small and round in the pocket. I hold out my hand, my eyes watering with the hard pellets of driving snow. And suddenly, I can remember. I can remember what I was holding in my hand. And I know why it set me running. It was a shell. A shotgun shell. It was the missing blank. Standing here in my own footsteps, the thoughts shoot across my brain just as they did that night, and I can remember them. It's like watching the snow melt and the familiar landscape emerge from beneath. It could have been there from the clay pigeon shoot earlier, but I know enough now from our shoot to tell the difference between a live round and a blank. Live shotgun rounds are solid in your hand, packed with pellets that make them feel heavier than their compact shape suggests. What I held that night was light as plastic with no shot at all. It was a blank. The blank. The blank that was supposed to have been in the shotgun. Claire had been the one to substitute the live round for the blank. And now, she'd just driven off into the night with James dying in the back of the car. Why? Why? It made no sense then, and it still makes no sense to me now. But then, I had no time to consider. I had only one option, to catch them up and confront Claire. Now, I have time. I turn slowly and walk back into the house, and I shut and lock the door behind me. Then I go into the living room and sit, my head in my hands, trying to figure it out. I cannot leave here until dawn, unless, that is, I get up, stiff with cold, and pick up the phone. No, it's still dead, the line simply hissing and crackling quietly. I am stuck then, stuck until daylight, unless I want to stagger back down that icy, rutted lane in the darkness once more, and I'm not sure I'd even make it. I go back to the sofa and huddle deeper into the throw, trying vainly to get some warmth back into my limbs. My God, I'm so tired. But I cannot sleep. I must figure this out. Claire substituted the live round. Therefore, Claire killed James. But it makes no sense. Claire has no motive, and she is the only person who could not have faked those texts. I have to think. The question I keep coming back to is why? Why would Claire kill James on the eve of their own wedding? And then suddenly, with a coldness that's totally different to the chill in the air, I remember Matt's words in the hospital. James and Claire were having problems. I shake it off almost immediately. This is ridiculous. Yes, Claire's life has to be perfect. Yes, she has incredibly high standards, but for God's sake, she's been dumped before. She held a massive grudge, I know that, because I sat by while she signed Rick's email up to every porn site and Viagra newsletter she could find, but she sure as hell didn't kill the bloke. But there is one big difference. When Rick dumped Claire, Flo wasn't in the picture. I think of Flo's words as she sobbed outside the bathroom on the first night. She's my rock, and I'd do anything for her. Anything. Anything? I remember her reaction to me going to bed. The way she'd exploded, accusing me of sabotage. "I'll kill you if you ruin it," she'd promised. I hadn't taken her seriously, but maybe I should have. And that was just a hen. What would she do to the man who was planning to leave her best friend at the altar? And who better to take the fall than the bad ex-friend who stole Claire's rightful property and then walked away for 10 long years? But now, it has all spiralled out of control. And then I remember the matching clothes Flo was wearing on that last night, and suddenly I realise. What if it wasn't Claire's coat on the rail, but Flo's, and Claire simply grabbed it by mistake? Flo. Flo was the one who picked up the gun. Flo was the one who told us it wasn't loaded. Flo was the person who set this entire weekend up, persuaded me to come, arranged the whole thing. And Flo could have sent that text. I feel like a web is closing round me. Like the more I fight, the more I will be tangled in it. James is dead. Claire is dying. Flo is dying. And somewhere, Nina is in her B&B at breaking point, and she and Tom are facing questions they cannot answer, suspicions they cannot shake. Please let me wake from this. I curl up on the sofa on my side and draw my knees into my chest, the throw tucked around myself. I have to think. I have to decide what to do. But in this confused, exhausted state, I find myself going round in circles. I have a choice. Wait here for the police, try to explain my presence, explain about the blank and Flo's jacket, and hope they believe me. Or I can leave at the crack of dawn and hope they don't realise I was here. But where do I go? To London? To Nina? How will I get away? The police will find me, of course, but it will look better than finding me here. Almost against my will, I can feel my eyes closing, and my limbs, quivery with tiredness, slowly relaxing, the muscles twitching with exhaustion every few minutes as they loosen into sleep. I cannot think. I will try to work it out tomorrow. A great yawn comes up from somewhere deep inside, and I realize I have stopped shivering. I let the flip-flops fall off my feet and realize a thin line of tears is tracing down my cheek from the yawn, but I'm too tired to wipe them away. Oh, God, I need to sleep. I will think about this tomorrow. It's night. It's the night of the shooting. And I'm crouched in the blazing hallway, bathed in the golden, streaming light. And in James's blood. The blood is in my nostrils, on my hands, beneath my nails. He's looking up at me, his eyes wide and dark and shining wet. "The text," he says, his voice is hoarse. "Leo." I reach out to touch his face, and then suddenly he's gone. The blood is gone, and the light is gone. I wake. It's dark and my heart is racing in my chest. For a minute, I just lie there, feeling my heart thumping like a drum, trying to work out what has woken me. I can't hear anything. But then I turn my head and I notice two things. The first is that outside the plate glass window to the front of the house is a dark shape that wasn't there before, and I'm pretty certain it's a car. The second is that I can hear a sound from the kitchen. It is a slow, juddering, scraping noise. It's the sound of a chair being pushed across the slate tiles as someone opens the door. Chapter 32. There is someone in the house. I sit, bolt upright, the throw falling from my shoulders, my heart thumping so high in my throat I feel sick. For a second, I think about calling out, challenging the intruder. Then I realize I'm insane. Whoever is here, for whatever reason they've come, it's not a good one. It's not the police. They wouldn't come like this in the dead of night, creeping in through the back door. No. There are only two possibilities. Some random burglar has got lucky and discovered the open back door. Or the murderer is here. I would love for it to be a burglar, which says something about how fucked up my life has become, that a random stranger breaking in here in the middle of the night would be the best possible explanation. But I know in my heart of hearts it's not. The murderer is here. For me. Very, very carefully, I get up, holding the throw around myself like a shield, as if the soft red wool can protect me. My one comfort is that the intruder won't want to put the lights on any more than I do. Maybe in the dark I can evade them, hide, escape. Fuck, where do I go? The windows in here open onto the garden, but I'm sure they're locked. I tried them from the outside, and I remember Flo locking them that last night. She had a key. I have no idea where it is. I can hear them in the kitchen. They are walking softly across the tiles. Two very strong impulses fight within me. The first is to run. Run out the door, up the stairs, lock myself in the bathroom, do whatever I can to get away. The second is to stand and fight. I am a runner. This is what I do. I run. But sometimes you can't run anymore. I stand, my fists clenched by my side, my blood a roaring in my ears, my breath a tearing in my throat. Flight or fight, flight or fight, flight or... Shoes crunch on the glass in the hallway, and then they stop. I know the murderer is there, listening. Listening for me. I hold my breath. And then the living room door swings wide. Someone is standing in the frame, and I cannot see who it is. In the dimness, all I can see is a shape, black against the reflecting steel of the front door. It could be anyone. They're huddled in a coat, and their face is hidden by the shadows. But then the figure moves, and I see the glint of blonde hair. Hello, Flo, I say, my throat so tight I can barely speak. And then she laughs. She laughs and laughs, and for a long moment I have no idea why. She moves, still smiling, into a strip of moonlight, her feet crunching on glass. And I understand. Because it's not Flo. It's Claire. She's holding herself up against the wall, and I realize that she's as frail as me. Maybe she wasn't as ill as she pretended when I saw her in the hospital, but she's ill all right. She holds herself like someone twice her age, like she's been beaten bloody and has only half healed.
Why did you come back?
She manages at last.
Why couldn't you just leave it?
Claire? I croak. It doesn't make sense. Nothing makes sense. She feels her way slowly to the sofa and then sinks down with a groan. In the thin, cloud-muted moonlight, she looks awful, worse than me. Her face is cut and there's a huge swollen bruise on one side of her forehead, black in the pale light. Claire, why? I can't make sense of this. She says nothing. Nina's rolling tobacco is on the table, along with Rizzler's, and she reaches for them, painfully, with a little gasp of relief as she sinks back into the cushions and begins slowly, painstakingly, to roll up. She is wearing gloves, but in spite of that, her hands are shaking, and she spills the tobacco twice before she lights up.
I haven't smoked in years.
She puts the end to her lips and takes a long drag.
God, I've missed it.
Why? I say again. Why are you here? I still can't make my brain accept what's happening. Claire is here, therefore she must be the killer, but why? How? There was no way she could have sent that first text. She was the one person in the house who could not have done it. I should be running. I should be cowering behind the sofa armed with a bread knife. But I can't make myself understand this. It's Claire, my brain keeps insisting. She's your friend. When she holds out the cigarette to me, I take it, half in a dream, and suck in the smoke, holding it deep until the trembling in my limbs stills and I feel my head get light. I go to hand it back and Claire shrugs.
Keep it. I can roll another. God, it's cold. Want a tea?
Thanks, I say, still in this strange, dreamlike state. Claire is the killer. But she can't be. I can't seem to think what to do, and so I take refuge in these strange, automatic social responses. She gets painfully to her feet and hobbles out into the kitchen, and in a few minutes I hear the click of the kettle and the bubbling hum as it begins to boil. What should I do? The roll-up has burnt out, and I set it gently onto the coffee table. There's no ashtray, but I no longer care. I shut my eyes, rub my hands over my face, and as I do, I get a flash, like a projection against the inside of my lids. James, the blood bright as paint under the light. The smell from my dream is still sharp in my nostrils. His hoarse voice is inside my head. There's a small sound from the doorway, and I see Claire shuffling painfully across with two mugs in her hand. She sets them down, and I take one, and she lowers herself to the sofa and pulls a packet of pills from her pocket and breaks two capsules into the tea, her fingers a little clumsy in their woolen gloves. "Painkillers?" I ask, more for something to say. She nods.
"Yes, you're supposed to swallow the capsules whole, but I can't swallow pills."
She takes a swig and shudders.
"Oh, God, that's disgusting. I'm not sure if it's the pills or if the milk's gone off."
I take a gulp of my own. It tastes vile. Tea always tastes vile, but this is even more vile than normal. It tastes sour and bitter below the sugar Claire has added, but at least it's hot. We sip in silence for a while, and then I can't keep quiet any longer. "What are you doing here, Claire? How did you get here?"
"I drove Flo's car. She lent it to my folks, and they left the keys in my locker for Flo to collect. Only she never did."
"No, she never did. Because..." Claire looks up. Her eyes over the top of her cup are dilated in the dimness, and they shine. She is so beautiful, even like this, huddled in an old coat with her face cut and bruised and no makeup on.
"As for what I'm doing here, I could ask the same about you. What are you doing here?"
"I came back to try to remember," I say.
"And did you?"
Her voice is light, as though we're talking about what happened in an old episode of Friends.
"Yes."
I meet her eyes in the darkness. The mug is hot between my numb hands.
"I remembered about the shell."
"What shell?"
Her face is blank, but there is something in her eyes.
"The shell in your jacket. I found it in the pocket of your coat."
She is shaking her head, and suddenly I find I am angry. Very, very angry. "Don't fuck with me, Claire. It was your coat. I know it was. Why would you come back here if not?"
"Maybe." She looks down at the mug and then up at me. "Maybe to protect you from yourself."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"You don't remember what happened, do you?"
"How do you know that?"
"The nurses. They talk. Especially when you're asleep, or might be."
"So? So what?"
"You don't remember what happened in the forest, do you? In the car?"
"What the hell are you on about?"
"You grabbed the wheel," she says softly. "You told me you couldn't live without James, that you'd been fucked up over him for 10 years. You told me that you'd dreamed about him, that you'd never got over what happened, what he said to you in that text. You drove us off the road, Lee."
It washes over me like a wave. I feel my cheeks tingle with the shock, as if she slapped me. And then it recedes, and I'm left gasping. Because it's the truth. As she says it, I get a sharp, agonizing flash. Hands on the wheel, Claire fighting me like a demon, my nails in her skin.
"Are you sure you're remembering this right?"
she says, her voice very gentle.
"I saw you, Lee. You had your hand on the barrel of the gun. You nudged it towards James."
For a minute, I can't say anything. I'm sitting here gasping, my hands gripping the teacup like it's a weapon. Then I'm shaking my head. "No. No, no, no. Why are you here in that case? Why aren't you denouncing me to the police?"
"How do you know," she says quietly, "that I haven't already done that?"
Oh, my God. I feel weak with horror. I take a long gulp of tea, my teeth chattering at the edge of the mug, and I try to think, try to gather the strands of all this together. This is not true. Claire is screwing with my head. No sane person would be sitting here drinking tea with a woman who murdered her fiancé and tried to drive their car off the road. "The shell," I say doggedly. "The shell was in your coat."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," she says, and there's a catch in her voice. "Please, Lee, I love you. I'm scared for you. Whatever you've done..."
I can't think. My head hurts. I feel so strange, and there's a vile taste in my mouth. I take another gulp of tea to try to swill it away, but the taste only intensifies. I shut my eyes, and the picture of James swims in front of my closed lids, dying in my arms. Is this the picture that I'm going to see when I close my eyes for the rest of my life?
"Text,"
he gasps.
"Text, Leo."
And there is blood in his lungs. And then suddenly, amid the swimming haze of memories and tangled suspicion, something catches. I know what James was saying, what he was trying to say. I put down the mug. I know what happened. And I know why James had to die. Chapter 33. Oh, my God. I've been so stupid. I can't believe how stupid. For 10 years, I never even noticed. I sit there, stock still, running through all the what-ifs, how different everything could have been if I'd only realized what was sitting in front of my face all those years ago.
"Lee?"
Claire says. She is looking at me, her face the picture of concern.
"Lee, are you okay? You don't look well."
"Nora. My name is Nora,"
I say hoarsely. For 10 years. For 10 years that fucking text has been engraved on my heart, and I never even noticed.
"Lee,"
I say to Claire. She takes a gulp of tea and stares at me over the mug, her beautiful narrow brows drawn into a puzzled frown.
"Lee," I repeat. "I'm sorry, but this is your problem, not mine. Deal with it, and don't call me again. Jay."
"What?"
"Lee."
"What the hell are you on about?"
"Lee. He never called me Lee. James never called me Lee."
For a minute, she stares at me in utter incomprehension, and I am reminded, all over again, what an amazing actress she was. Is. It shouldn't have been James on the stage. It should have been Claire. She is amazing.
and then she sets down her tea and gives a rueful grimace.
Jesus, it was a long time ago, Lee.
It's not an admission, not quite, but I know her well enough to know that it might as well be. She's not protesting anymore.
10 years.
I'm slow, I say bitterly. Bitter not just because my mistake ruined my own life, but because if I'd been a little quicker on the uptake, James might still be alive.
Why did you do it, Claire?
She reaches out her hand to me. I flinch away, and she says,
Look, I'm not saying what I did was right. I was young, and it was stupid. But, Lee, I did it for the best. You'd have been screwing up both your lives. Look, I went round to see him that afternoon. The guy was shitting himself. He wasn't ready to be a dad. You weren't ready to be a mum. But I knew between the two of you, neither of you would have the guts to take the decision.
No, I say. My voice is shaking.
You wanted it to happen, both of you.
No. It comes out like a sob.
You can deny it all you want,
she says softly.
But you were the one that walked away, and he let you. All it would have taken was one text, one message, one call. The truth would have come out. But between you, you couldn't even manage that. The fact is, he wanted out. He was just too much of a coward to make a break for it himself. I did it for the best.
You're lying, I say at last. My voice is hoarse and choked.
You don't care. You never cared. You just wanted James, and I was in the way.
I remember that day in the school hall, the hot sun streaming in through the tall glass windows, and Claire saying laconically,
I'm going to have James Cooper.
But instead, he became mine.
He found out, didn't he?
I stare at her pale face, her draggled hair silver white in the moonlight.
About the text.
How? She sighs. And then, at last, she speaks what sounds like the truth.
I told him.
What?
I told him. We were having a discussion about honesty and marriage. He said that before we got married, he wanted to get something off his chest. He asked, could he tell me something and would I forgive him? And I said, yes, anything, absolutely anything. I said I loved him, that he could tell me anything. And he told me that at that party where we met up again, his friend had been interested in me. We'd spent all night flirting, I remember. I gave this friend my number at the end of the night, and James said that he found the piece of paper in his friend's pocket and kept it himself. He told his friend that I wasn't interested, and instead, he texted me. Said that he got my number off Julian, and did I want to go out for a drink. She sighs and stares out of the window. He said it had been eating at him all these years.
She carries on.
That our relationship had started with a lie, that it was his friend who should have ended up with me, that he said that Julian was a womanizer, and he'd done it partly for selfish reasons, but partly for me. He couldn't bear for Julian to string me along, screw me, and then dump me. He was expecting me to be angry, but as he talked, all I could think was that he lied and cheated to get me, bent his own scruples. You know what James is like, was like.
I nod. The movement makes my head swim, but I know what she means. James was a contradictory mix, an anarchist with his own rigid moral code.
It was strange.
Claire is speaking slowly now. I think she's almost forgotten about me.
He thought his confession would make me love him less, but it didn't. It only made me love him more. I realized what he'd done was for me, for love of me.
and I realized that the same was true of me, that I had lied out of love for him. And I thought, if I can forgive him... I can see it. I can see her twisted logic and her one-upmanship. You have done this for me. I have done worse for you. I love you even more. But she fatally misunderstood James. I sit, trying to imagine his face as she confessed what she'd done. Did she try to justify it to him as she did to me? He wasn't ready to be a dad. She was absolutely right. But that wouldn't have swayed James. He would have seen only the cruelty of the deception. What did you say to him? I say at last. I am light-headed with tiredness, and my body feels strange and disconnected, my muscles like wool. Claire looks just as bad. Her wrists seem thin enough to snap.
What do you mean?
You must have told him something else, otherwise he would have rung me. What did you say?
Oh.
She rubs her temple, hooks back a lock of hair that has fallen over her face.
I can't remember. I said something about... You told me to tell him you needed time alone, and that you thought he'd screwed up your life and you didn't want to see him. He shouldn't ring you. You'd contact him when you were ready.
But of course I never did. I went back to school only to take my exams and ignored him steadfastly. Then I moved away completely. Part of me wants to smack him for being so stupid, for being taken in so easily. Why didn't he overcome his scruples and just call me? But I know the answer. It's the same reason I never called him. Pride. Shame. Cowardice. And something else, something more like shell shock, that made it easier just to keep on going, not look back. Something momentous had happened in our lives, something we were totally unequipped to deal with. And we were both dazed from the fallout, trying not to think too much, feel too much. Easier just to shut down.
What did he say?
I manage at last. My throat is sore and croaky, and I take another gulp of tea. It tastes even worse cold, but perhaps the sugar and caffeine will help keep me awake until morning. Until the police come. I am so tired. So very, very tired.
Afterwards, I mean, when he found out.
Claire sighs. He wanted to call off the wedding. And I begged and pleaded. I said he was being like Angel in Tess of the D'Urbervilles. You know, when Angel confesses to adultery but then can't bear it when Tess says she had Alex's baby. We studied the book at GCSE. I can still remember James's impassioned condemnation of Angel to the class.
He's being a fucking hypocrite,
he shouted, and got sent out for swearing in front of a teacher.
He said he needed time to think, but that the only way he could ever even try to forgive me was if I told you the truth. So I told him I'd invited you to my hen party, so that I could tell you then.
She laughs unsteadily. Like someone suddenly seeing the point of a joke.
It's just occurred to me how ironic it is. I always thought Hindus were completely lame, and James spent ages trying to persuade me to have one. And in the end, he was the one who persuaded me, just not for the reason he thought. If he hadn't kept going on about it, I'd probably never even have thought of all this.
I understand now. I understand completely. Claire could never be in the wrong. Someone else always had to take the fall. Someone else had to take the blame.
Did James ever really know her? Or did he just love some illusion of Claire, an act that she presented to him?
Because I know from 20 years of knowing Claire that his plan was never going to work. Hell would freeze over before Claire would admit to something like that. Not just because she would be in the wrong to me, but because she would be in the wrong to everyone, forever. I could not be expected to keep quiet about what happened. It would have all come out. 10 years of lying and deception and, most humiliating of all, the fact that Claire Cavendish had had to resort to this to get her man. She must have known, too, that James's decision was on a knife edge. I don't know what he said to Matt, but it was